Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How far would you go to find the perfect plate of ribs or brisket or sausage? The meat singing with the ideal blend of smoke, spice, and salt, and those flavors complemented exquisitely by whatever is offered on the side. Daniel Vaughn used to have a regular job. He was an architect from Ohio, no less, who moved to Texas and realized he had a great love of barbecue and a talent for writing about it. Today, as Texas Monthly's first and only barbecue editor, his work takes him all over the state to sample the remarkable variety of techniques pitmasters have created for slow-cooking pork and beef. He's also the author of the 2013 book, The Prophets of Smoked Meat, A Journey Through Texas Barbecue. He joins us to talk about his latest discovery and about what it takes to eat hundreds of servings of barbecue a year and live to talk about it. Daniel, welcome back to Think.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Chris.
You are less strident in your, maybe strident's not the wrong word, but you are less strict about your definitions of barbecue today than you were when you started out.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, when you start to really delve into a subject, you start to understand the nuances of it. Oftentimes, I'll start a conversation and people will tell me their idea of what traditional barbecue is, and very oftentimes in Texas, that is a brisket that is slow smoked and an offset smoker, and to them, that is traditional barbecue. And I have to remind them that, you know, brisket really didn't come into prominence into Texas until about the 60s, brisket specifically. Offset smokers, as we know them in our backyard, were really a product of the 70s. And slow smoking isn't the way that some of the more famous places in Texas do it, like Kreitz Market and Lockhart, where they're cooking at 500 degrees or so, and places like Cooper's and Llano, where the temperatures get up to, you know, that same 500, 600 degrees. So instead of that 250, 225 degree low and slow, briskets going for 18 hours. There are a lot of places in Texas where briskets get done in 4 or 5 hours. So just the multitude of ways that brisket is prepared, that really any barbecue is prepared in Texas, has so much variation that it's really impossible to say this is the definition of barbecue. And not, you can't even say this is the definition of Texas barbecue.
What did we eat before brisket?
Well, so if
what did we barbecue before brisket?
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. What did we eat? I have no idea. No, but if you go back to the history of Texas barbecue, they were really big events. You know, if a railroad made it to a town, they'd have a big barbecue, always on the 4th of July. Later on, Juneteenth became one of those big events. And so you would essentially dig a trench in the ground. You would build a fire in that trench. You'd let it burn down overnight. You would either put saplings or later on you would put metal grates over top of that pit. And you would cook large hunks of meat, whether that's if you go to the community barbecue that's still held in Milheim, Texas, down near I-10, they were cooking veal. They weren't cooking veal because they liked the flavor of veal. That's what they could fit on the pit. Huh. You would just as often see things like whole goats or whole pigs. Or if you go back to 1941 inauguration, where Pappy O'Daniel famously dug a trench in the lawn of the governor's mansion, and one of the things he cooked on there was a buffalo that he had shot a couple of days before. So, I mean, the variation of meats is quite wide. Now, if you go into the meat markets in Texas and Central Texas, it was much more often that you'd find items from the beef forequarter that were cooked. So that's your shoulder clods, chuck rolls, chuck ribs, and then, of course, brisket being part of that as well. It really wasn't until the 1960s where individual cuts of meat started to be packaged, and so you could buy a box of briskets. You know, you get five briskets to a box. Before that, it was really just anything from the forequarter. So you would go into a place like City Market in Luling, a very famous place, and you would just ask for barbecue beef. You might ask for a lean or a fatty cut of that, but you weren't going in ordering brisket or any specific cut of meat. So it wasn't until the 60s that we started to get a specific menu item of brisket.
Was it butcher shops that were the first to sell it already cooked?
That's something actually I've been delving into quite a bit. Actually, just yesterday, I was really doing some research as well, trying to find the origins of smoked brisket as well as pastrami. there's a book coming out by Robert Sietsema, actually, that I got an advanced copy of to review. And in it, he talks a lot about some of the Jewish delis in Texas and some of the menu items that they had that were really, they had pastrami on the menus back in 1908 in Dallas and El Paso and Corpus Christi. And, that's about the time when pastrami started to be cooked at Katz's Deli, the very famous Katz's in New York, where, it's generally given the credit as being the place where pastrami came to prominence. But I found so many different places where smoked brisket, smoked tongue, and pastrami were actually being cooked right here in Texas at that same time. And it was so hard to find because they used so many different variations, pastromer, pastroma, pastromi. So once I figured out all those different variations and started to search for those, the search became a little easier.
It's fascinating how much cultural crossover there is in Texas barbecue.
Oh, well, yeah. It's a huge state, obviously. So on the eastern side of the state, you have so much influence from the South. So much of the slave population that was cooking all of the barbecue in the South anyway was coming over to East Texas and bringing those traditions with them. In South Texas, you have the traditions coming over from the border. Really, those traditions were being born before there was a border down there of barbacoa, whether it's and also goat barbecue, cabrito. And so then you get out to West Texas or the Hill Country, and they're still cooking the way that those community barbecues were done. It might be in slightly fancier contraptions that are a little more likable to the health department, but they're essentially cooking direct heat, over coals. And so it's really Central Texas barbecue is certainly the most well-known of the styles of barbecue here in Texas, but it really, that slow smoking, served on butcher paper, all that's so recognizable and usually is copied around the country when people are copying Texas barbecue, that's really just one small part of what Texas barbecue is.
Cabrito can be so delicious, and people love it. I spent years in El Paso, so it was a really popular thing there at barbecues. Why isn't it around more?
Well, a lot of it is just how expensive it is. If you look at a cabrito, it's usually the carcass is going to weigh about 8 pounds, and it'll probably be around $100, anywhere from $80 to $100 for that. So just the raw product itself is already $10 a pound. And then you've got the traditional way of serving it is in 8 different pieces. So you're going to be serving quite a large piece of that. So if you can imagine being a restaurateur, cooking a multitude of meats, having one of them be cabrito, and at the end of the day, maybe somebody didn't buy all your cabrito, you're out a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
And if also on the flip side, if you're a customer going into a place and you have all these options that are $10, $15 a pound, and then the cabrito is $25, there's a good chance that you're going to go with those other options. So even the people who are very successful on the in the goat cook-off circuit, even those people that are really successful at that and have restaurants, they'll tell you, well, it's just not worth their money to actually serve it in the restaurant.
I love that you're now familiar with the goat cook-off circuit.
Well, I guess it's not much of a circuit. There's a few of them in Texas. I recently was able to judge the one in Brady late last year.
What is the deal with the price of brisket?
Well, we just don't have as many head of cattle is the biggest thing. The price of beef itself is going up, and most of that has to do with the decimation of the cattle herds based on the drought, and that's the drought here in Texas, drought in California as well. And really, we're at a point where the demand for beef and the demand for brisket isn't diminishing. The demand for brisket itself is going up at a crazy rate. But our supply is just so diminished, and it's so hard to recover. It takes so long to replenish a herd of cattle. So while beef itself is up about 25% or so over last year, brisket is up closer to 50 or 60%, depending on the grade of brisket that you're going to buy. So the popularity of brisket all over the country with the explosion of Texas barbecue, Texas-style barbecue places in places like New York and Seattle and L.A., as well as just the popularity of Texas barbecue within Texas. You got all these new places opening up. the demand for brisket is like none other. And then you have places like Arby's putting it on their menu, and not, you know, rather than going into the ground beef market where you could really go anywhere in the cow, there's only two briskets. So when a place like Arby's and just all these other barbecue joints all across the country are all vying for those two briskets, you know, it, the price just tends to skyrocket. And it's gone from around $2 just 2 years ago, $2 a pound, mm-hmm. to close to $4 a pound right about now. There are even some of the more specialty briskets, the all-natural briskets, are going for $5 a pound. And when you imagine that then when a pitmaster takes that brisket, trims it, puts it on the smoker, cooks it down, and then serves it, what they're serving is about half of that weight. So if you buy a 10-pound brisket for $4 a pound, you're really paying $8 a pound when you are able to serve only 5 pounds of that brisket.
And it temporarily got cheaper, right, as ranchers were culling their herds. So there was like an oversupply for a short time. So that probably makes the cost spike seem even more dramatic.
It makes the cost spike seem more dramatic, and it also makes the recovery a lot harder. If you're a rancher and you were just kind of dabbling in it and you had to just sell off your herd because you had no grass and no water on your ranch, you had to sell that herd off at cut rate prices, and those cattle were probably pretty skinny. So when you're selling by the pound, now you're buying back by the pound at three or four times that price. A lot of people are just choosing not to get back into it.
You mentioned this demand for Texas-style barbecue in many parts of the country. It's kind of a gourmet item in some of these, you know, hot restaurant markets. Do you worry at all that it's going to have this moment in the way that, like, Tex-Mex did? And people still like Tex-Mex. People are still eating it. But it's sort of not the thing that anybody's talking about anymore.
Right. Well, you know, I've been certainly this whole rise in the popularity of barbecue, I've certainly benefited from quite a bit. But because of that, as we've gone on, I've continued to look back and think, well, maybe it's at its height right now. And I thought that 5 years ago, I thought that 2 years ago, and it just keeps getting more and more popular. Now, will people in New York get sick of it? Will they be, you know, as they say, so over barbecue or over brisket? I certainly see that as a possibility, but barbecue in Texas has been part of our culture for so long. I don't see that diminishing. And, you know, as long as barbecue is popular here in Texas, then my job as the Texas Monthly barbecue editor is safe. So really, as far as long as that culture stays rich here within our borders, I'll be happy.
What have you discovered about the challenges of writing about, and your work delves into history and you introduce characters. It's not just you reviewing plate after plate of food, but you're still, in most cases, eating what amounts for most people to kind of the same plate of food over and over. To describe the experience in different ways, has that been easier than you expected, harder than you expected?
It's hard. You know, how many ways can you say smoky? And, you know, there's moist and juicy. You know, how many more synonyms do you have there? But yeah, it does become a challenge. Now, when I was writing my old blog, 95% of what I did was barbecue joint reviews. Now that I'm the barbecue editor, what I do on tmbbq.com is about less than 20% of that is barbecue joint reviews. I really do one of those a week. So it gets a little bit easier, and I'm able to, you know, wade through a few places that don't really have a great story or really have great food to get to one that has a better story to tell, or a place that's kind of out of the way that I want to tell people about and really make sure that they can go out of their way to find it as well.
Daniel Vaughn is with us. He's barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. He blogs for the magazine at tmbbq.com. We'll come back to our discussion of the delights of Texas barbecue in a couple of minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs, accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Daniel Vaughn, who blogs at tmbbq.com and is the barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Because you have this interest in barbecue history, you will sometimes profile people. Can you tell us about the Hardeman family in Dallas? Four generations of barbecuers.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, you have these big names in Dallas that are well known, like, you know, the Bryan family with Sonny Bryans. But the Hardeman family is less well known, but their history goes back nearly as far. Really in the 40s in Freedmanstown, the patriarch of the family opened a barbecue joint there that was where Uptown is today, and moved to West Dallas and then moved to South Dallas now. So there are three Hardeman's barbecues that are still going strong here in Dallas. Now, you know, it's the menu there is a little bit more varied as well. So if you're used to going to a place like, you know, Pecan Lodge, where you're getting just brisket and ribs and sausage, you go into the Hardeman's Barbecue. There's one at Keyston Hampton, and you can get pork ribs right along with your oxtails. You can get chitlins, pork chops, and, of course, brisket and hot links as well.
When you are planning a trip, because you sometimes will take these long sort of, I guess, jaunts around the state, I know that you have to be pretty strategic about how much you eat at each place. I was surprised to read that you said you can usually tell within two bites how something's going to be. What are you tasting for on the first bite? And what are you tasting for on the second bite?
Well, it really the reason it only takes a couple of bites is because it really starts before then. I mean, you're watching it on the cutting board. Hopefully, if they're cutting it in front of you, which is to me always preferred, you can see how the meat reacts to the knife and to the cutting board. And then when you pick it up with your hands, I don't like to eat with a knife and fork. You can tell so much by the texture of it and the moisture level and all of that just by picking it up and it, if it's a slice of brisket, pulling it apart. As far as the flavor goes, I mean, you're looking for, you know, that right balance of smokiness and seasoning, but you still want to taste the beef or the pork or whatever's under there as well. And so then, you know, you've already got the moisture and the texture figured out by the time you even take that first bite. And the second bite is really just a kind of a confirmation.
Everybody wants to come along and help you. I guess you've discovered what you want and what you don't want in a traveling companion.
Yes. So everybody wants to come, including my children. I have a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And so my 5-year-old daughter says, "Dad, take me to work today. I really want to go to work with you." This is over the summer. She's in kindergarten now. And so I said, "All right, you're just going on a regular work day." So we drove down to Austin from here. We went to 5 barbecue joints, and we drove back. And my wife asked her if she had a great time, and she said, "We don't need to do that anymore." My son, on the other hand, he got to go with me out to a pig farm, to a hog ranch out in West Texas for his day with Dad. And the next morning, he said, Can we go out to the pig ranch again?" And I said, "Well, that doesn't happen every day." But as far as like a traveling companion, a regular traveling companion, oftentimes I like to do it myself just because of how much more quickly I can do things. Mm-hmm. I don't have to feel like I need to be polite to another person or a guest. And I also tend to eat a little bit less too, because, you know, you sit and you linger and you're talking with somebody who's across the table. But if it is somebody who's going to come with me, generally after the first trip, they don't really want to do it again. I mean, I think there's an idea that they're going to come out on the road with me and we're going to go do like a greatest hits tour.
Right.
And it's not like that. It's, you know, most of the stops that we're going to go to are going to be mediocre. They're going to be okay barbecue, and maybe a couple of them will be great, but it's certainly you're going to be in it for, it's going to feel like a work day.
In terms of, like, the chain places that now have multiple outlets around the state, do you have any favorites?
Well, you know, Rudy's Barbecue is one of those that generally does a good job. So there was a friend of mine on Twitter who described it as it's not a great first choice, but it's a great last resort.
I don't know. It's like faint praise, but.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so many of the chains out there just, you know, they're really all about quantity over quality. And I think Rudy's is one of those. They still put out a lot of barbecue, but you still have a really good chance of getting a good meal there.
Are there other ingredients that, like, particular parts of the state will specialize in? Like, we talked a little bit about cabrito, and then there's lengua. And are there things that get barbecued only in some parts of Texas?
Yeah, you know, I call these like these little micro styles. So if you go get closer to the Louisiana border, it's a lot more often that you're going to find smoked boudin. You know, you're not going to find smoked boudin probably a whole lot in the hill country.
What's boudin?
Oh, boudin is a pork and rice sausage, so it's stuffed into a natural casing, mm-hmm. but it's primarily rice. And so I went to Ray's Barbecue in Houston, and he described it, the owner there, Ray Bush, described it as his homemade boudin as a Texas-style boudin. And I asked him what that meant. He said it's more rice than it is pork. The pork isn't so heavy because it's a side dish. And so it's like Baby Back Shack here in Dallas. You can go order your three meat tray at Baby Back Shack and get boudin as a side. Now, if you go down to Southeast Texas, you'll find links of a different variety. They're all beef links, and they call them juicy links, spicy links, or just beef links. And they're all beef. There's no pork. There's no pork fat. The casing is a beef casing, so it's a lot harder. You can't really bite through it in most cases. And it's spiced really heavily with garlic, paprika, sometimes chili powder, cumin. And it's also a lot of fat in it. So it's like a ratio of about 50-50. So when you cut into it, I mean, it really just kind of seeps out onto your plate. The trick is to get a piece of white bread under there to capture it all if you want to make sure to get all those calories. But that's something that you're really just going to find in Southeast Texas, like in Beaumont, the Beaumont, Port Arthur area, over into Galveston, and some places in Houston do those beef links as well. And then here closer to North Texas, if you go up towards Sherman, Denison, you get this brown gravy sauce. And so it's essentially you capture the brisket drippings in the smoker, and then you thicken it just like gravy with flour. You basically make a roux, and you thicken those brisket drippings, add a little bit of spice to them. So it's a completely different type of barbecue sauce.
I can't remember why this came up recently, but I was reading about like liquid smoke and what that is. Would any self-respecting barbecue joint ever use liquid smoke for any purpose?
No.
Does it happen, though?
Yeah, I'm sure it does happen. I actually was talking with a friend of mine, Travis Heim. He used to work for a place out in Fort Worth that shall remain nameless. And he said that the first step that they did with their brisket was to take the entire brisket and submerge it into a large vat of liquid smoke.
Wow.
Before they smoked it. It seemed like the craziest thing to me, but I guess that infused a whole other level of smoke flavor. But, you know, liquid smoke, it's one of those things that you can taste it pretty quickly. I mean, it's not. It doesn't taste like real smoke when you put it onto meat. You might be able to fake it in a barbecue sauce. Like, okay, is that drippings or is that liquid smoke? But, I mean, once you put it on meat, like, there's no way to fool somebody.
So is great barbecue made by what you rub on it or how good the meat is? Or is it made by the way that it is processed and heated and cooked?
So I just interviewed John Miller of John Miller Barbecue of the famous Miller family, sometimes pronounced Mueller, but down in Taylor in Austin. He's in Austin, Texas, and he said that of the people who he can't teach properly, he said he's a bad teacher anyway, but those who really can't pick it up are ones that they just don't pay attention. Hmm. It's paying attention to the fire, paying attention to the meat, and so much of it is knowing when it's done. The way I describe it, it's like make sure it's not undercooked. It can be a little bit more overcooked. That window is a little wider on that end. It's like when you're on the putting green, you know, if 0% of short putts go in, right?
Right.
So 0% of undercooked briskets taste good. But some overcooked briskets can still taste pretty good, right? If they're a little bit over tender, maybe get into that kind of roast beefy category. But really, it's that window of knowing when it's done. What you're rubbing on it, the kind of wood you're using, even the kind of smoker you're using, those things are all play a role and are all important to their own degree, but nothing like the like knowing the level of doneness.
Is there any value to you at all when you're looking for places that you want to try? Do you ever use Yelp just to get a sense of what people are saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm certainly never going to use Yelp to help form opinions about a place or help determine if I'm going to go to a place. But I use Yelp kind of in the same way that I would use that different barbecue joint's Facebook page. Mm-hmm. Do they have photos of their food? There's so much you can tell about the photos of a restaurant's food. And once you've eaten enough slices of brisket, you can tell what a good slice of brisket looks like or not. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not going to visit it. It just determines how much of a high priority I'm going to make sure to make that, to place that one in my itinerary.
So people ask you personal questions that I gather they didn't ask you when you were designing buildings for a living. People seem to be very concerned about the state of your health. Is that invasive to you? Does it bother you that people ask you these questions?
It doesn't bother me, but I do laugh at it. I wonder, like, what other profession? I guess professional athletes, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, their weight and their height and everything, all their physical characteristics are constantly talked about. But, I mean, really, how many jobs out there do people feel comfortable with just approaching you in a restaurant? So what is your cholesterol score? Have you gained weight? It's like, well, yeah, I mean, I've been at this job for 2 years eating barbecue nonstop, so certainly that's going to come along with it. But, yeah, it isn't something that bothers me, but, yes, I do find it extremely funny.
Have you been closely following this, like, new tide of research that suggests maybe, you know, dietary fat is not the culprit? And are you sort of hoping that bears out with time?
Well, I mean, it's like anything in moderation, and I don't do moderation with barbecue. So mm-hmm. That kind of goes out the window. But you could go back to some of the research at Texas A&M that's been out there for a little while that says the polyunsaturated fats within brisket fat are really different structure than a lot of the fat within the rest of the cow. And so it's actually healthier for you and a little bit closer to in structure to lard, like pork lard, than it is to other types of beef fat. So there's some hope, I guess.
Are there things that barbecue places do that are really surprising? Like, does anybody barbecue, you know, a fillet of fish? Or is there something creative you can do with other than pork and beef and lamb?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot you could do out there. I know, actually, just at lunch today, I went to Clark Food and Wine down in Lower Greenville. They have a smoked Arctic char and smoked shrimp. I know at Two Brothers Barbecue in San Antonio, they have a smoked shrimp. Those are more like smoked flavored items, though. Mm-hmm. When at the Texas Monthly Barbecue Festival, Wayne Miller from Louis Miller Barbecue came, and he did, as one of his tasting items for that festival, was racks and racks of lamb chops. And wow, those really took the smoke well, and those are something that you just aren't normally going to find on a menu. You might find them on special here at Lockhart Smokehouse in town every once in a while, but lamb chops really do take the smoke well.
How much is barbecue variable? I mean, you have like a restaurant that maybe has had the same, you know, formula, the same technique for doing things for years or for decades, but each animal that they're barbecuing is going to be different. There's going to be humidity one day and dry heat the next. How much does that matter?
Well, yeah, there's so many variables that go into every day that you're cooking. One of the biggest variables you have to deal with as a restaurateur is holding the meat, is simply how long ago was it done? And that to me seems to be the biggest challenge. It's going into a place at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and getting good barbecue, because as soon as that barbecue comes off the smoker and has had its proper resting time, and at that point it's at its peak, and from there on out it's doing nothing but getting worse, right? And then once you slice it, I mean, it's completely done with. So there's a place on I-45 in Centerville, if you've seen the exit, for Woody's Smokehouse, and they serve their brisket already sliced, and it's already like in a big warming tray already sliced there, and it's the driest, crustiest, depending on the time of day, just could be some of the nastiest brisket you could eat. So it's all in the way that you hold it. And so if you are able to overcome that, then, you know, that's one of your biggest battles as a restaurateur that the regular backyard cook doesn't have. A lot of places now, they overcome that by selling out. So they do as much meat as they can serve for lunch, and then they put out the sold-out sign, and they're done. So they don't have to worry about that lag time between lunch and dinner. So really that category of restaurant that is open for lunch and dinner has a lot more challenges putting out good, fresh barbecue.
And, of course, having a line out the door for whatever you're making creates a sort of mystique.
Yes.
And Pecan Lodge, although I understand the food is amazing, certainly has been the recipient of that, the idea that you have to get it now or you might not get it.
Yeah, well, the places with lines certainly get a lot of attention. They also get a lot of disdain from other folks and maybe from other businesses about maybe they're not worth it or so. But as soon as a business gets a line of their own, they don't think lines are such a bad thing.
It's like winning awards, right?
Exactly.
They're so stupid until you get one.
Exactly. But it does tell you something about a place because you're not going to – you might wait in line – you might see that line for a few weeks or a few months if the hype is all there. And I hate the word hype being misused. To me, hype is a place that has all the reputation but can't really back it up.
Mm-hmm.
And so if once people get beyond those first couple of months and they're still coming back and they're still waiting in line and they're still eating this food, then it's no longer hype. I mean, it's just really worth it. Now, it's hard to argue with Franklin Barbecue that is it really worth it to stand in line for 4 hours? I don't know. I love their food. I think their brisket is incredible. Texas Monthly, we named it the number one place in all of Texas. But it is hard to tell people who are looking for a place to go eat in their first time in Austin, well, go to Franklin, just you're going to be in line for 3 or 4 hours. As long as you go in with a mindset knowing that that's all part of the experience and you might as well just treat it like a tailgate party up until that point, then you're good. But I can see how it could certainly sour somebody who just kind of shows up not knowing what they're getting into.
Do you get lobbied when these lists are about to come out by restaurants that hope that you'll pick them?
No, I didn't hear anything from anyone. I heard a few grumbles afterwards, but not really. Certainly not anything of people trying to vying to get on the list.
I guess if you're busy all day, like tending the meat with the great care that you describe, you don't really have a whole lot of time for self-promotion.
Well, and the other thing, I mean, when you make it onto the Texas Monthly Top 50, certainly your business goes up. But of the ones that aren't on the Top 50, if they have a customer base that is loyal to them and they're continuing to please those customers and those people keep coming back, I mean, to them, that might be just plenty of success on its own.
We're speaking with Texas Monthly Barbecue editor Daniel Vaughn. You can find his blog for the magazine at tmbbq.com. If you'd like to talk to us about Texas barbecue, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Texas Monthly Barbecue editor Daniel Vaughn. We have an email here from Oliver who says, I love barbecue, but am always slightly confused as to why after all the hard work and attention to detail given to the meat, it is served with really bad quality bread.
Bad quality bread and often poor quality sides as well. I think so much of it has to do with the smaller barbecue joints out there are family run. Often there's one or two people who are doing the bulk of the work. And if you're spending all your time tending the meat, it's sometimes hard to do those other things like make a homemade potato salad or sometimes even make a homemade barbecue sauce. And the bread, however, is one of those things that almost seems like it's almost traditional to have that cheap white bread.
Yeah, like Wonder Bread, right?
Yeah, the Wonder Bread. I mean, a lot of that also has to do with the fact that it's free. mean, if you're going to be giving away free pickles, free onions, and free bread, are you going to be, you know, baking up your own sourdough and doing some artisan pickled onions? Probably not. I mean, you're going to have to start charging for it at that point. So I think a lot of it also has to do with the fact that it just doesn't cost you anything.
Another email here from Stephen who says, can you rank the sides in terms of importance? I go potato salad, coleslaw, then beans, maybe green beans next. Mac and cheese is just weird.
Yeah, I get often that fried okra is just weird. You know, onion rings, all those things. I mean, for me, it's not ranking those three, but those three are kind of the pinnacle. Like, almost every barbecue joint that you go into is going to have coleslaw, pinto beans, and potato salad.
And there've got to be pickles too, right?
There's got to be pickles and onions, yes. Got to be pickles and raw onions as well. So, I mean, for me, it's those three kind of as a group. They're inseparable as far as I'm concerned. Now, pinto beans, I mean, the pinto beans would be so bad out of a can and so great when they're made with, you know, leftover chopped brisket and they're made from dried beans. I mean, they can really kind of hold their own.
It's funny that beans are often served out of a can because they're pretty easy to make well if you've got the raw ingredients.
And if you've got the time.
Yeah.
And that time is really just them sitting around in a pot, right? So if you're already at the restaurant sitting around watching your brisket, why not just have a pot of beans on as well? So, yeah, I'm with you. It kind of makes sense to me to start off with some dried beans, and they're so much better. It's just really no comparison.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to, looks like, Petrie or Petri in Dallas. Hi.
Hi, Chris. Yes, it's Petrie.
Hi, Petrie.
This is such a fun conversation. I'm a vegetarian, and I'm still totally enjoying this conversation.
I'm so glad.
Thank you guys for having it. Daniel, I wanted to know if you think there is absolutely something that should never be barbecued.
Oh, something that should never be barbecued. Well, I did cringe a bit, and I'm sorry you're not going to like this answer, but Ironworks Barbecue in Austin, to pander to the South by Southwest crowd, put some smoked tofu on the menu. That seemed like an odd direction.
Did you actually taste it, though?
No, I didn't taste it, and I'm certainly willing to try it.
Mm-hmm.
But and, you know, maybe it is great. I don't know. There's a possibility there.
All right, you'll have to report back to us after you get to it sometime. I suppose there's only, you know, you say pandering to the South by Southwest crowd. At some point, like, to really work, a barbecue joint has to go pretty pure, right?
Well, yeah, but if you look at the Slow Bone here in Dallas, I know that a lot of the focus there is obviously on the barbecue meats, but they've also focused on creating a variety of side items that don't have meat in them. Mm-hmm. So I know in a barbecue joint, it's you know, it's very tempting to add bacon to everything or to add leftover sausage to the beans and leftover beef to whatever. But there they have a whole variety of sides that are vegetarian friendly. And so it allows, you know, families to go together who might not all eat the same way, and allows me to take my wife there who doesn't really like barbecue.
She doesn't like barbecue. So are you, like, at the end of a tough day, are you able to unload to her about what went on, or is she like, please don't even tell me about this?
Oh, no. She doesn't mind at all me talking about the barbecue. It's just as long as I don't take her to the barbecue joint.
What do you do with the leftovers?
Well, it all depends. I mean, there's some leftovers that just simply aren't worth saving.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I like to do is, especially with anything pork-related, is to take it home, cook it down, make a stock out of it, and use that stock to make some beans at home with the chopped up leftovers. So chopped up leftover brisket, things like that. So and also brisket chili. Brisket chili is really good. Just start with a pan of diced onions and some bacon, and then throw in leftover chopped brisket and a bunch of chili powder, and yeah, let it simmer for a while. It's good.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Ed in Arlington. Hey, Ed.
Hi. So you were talking earlier about the origins of the food barbecue, but it's my understanding that there is no real agreement or understanding on where the word barbecue comes from. And I have a couple of theories that I'd like to run past you and see what
okay.
you think. Well, one would be the word you mentioned earlier from the Spanish influence in Texas, which was here long before Anglos were, and that's the word barbacoa. And then the other word would be... phrase you were talking about the food kind of migrating here from the greater south, the southern U.S., and part of that would be French-speaking Louisiana. And in French, the word barbe is beard, and queue is tail. So you've got possibly from the beard to the tail, which means possibly butchering the whole animal for use in cooking, and that's where I think the word barbecue comes from.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, as far as what linguists who have researched this will tell you is that it's hard to have a definitive way that we came to the word barbecue. But most do agree that it came from what is present day Haiti, where they were calling actually what they were cooking on a variation of a barbacoa or barbacote. And so that term for the cooking mechanism, the actual frame of sticks that they were cooking on, became the word barbacoa to describe the food that was actually being cooked on it, barbacoa becoming barbecue. One thing that most any linguist you talk to will agree upon is that the whole beard-to-tail thing from French is bogus.
It sounded cool.
Yeah. Well, and that's... Again, if you talk to linguists, generally the thing that sounds really cool and convenient
is not the thing. Michael in Louisville wants to know your preferred wood for preparing barbecue.
Well, really it's just about starting with a hardwood. I mean, obviously you want to stay away from pine and cedar. And then here in Texas, it's mesquite, pecan, oak, and hickory. In the backyard, I like to cook with either pecan or oak. That's just what I prefer. I like mesquite if I'm going to be doing either something directly over the coals or if I'm just going to be applying some quick smoke flavor to something. So like a mesquite chips on a charcoal grill. But as far as slow and low smoking in the backyard, it's going to be pecan and oak for me.
You don't actually make your own charcoal?
Well, I don't make my own charcoal, but if you burn the wood down to coals, like if you just have a fire pit, I have a bunch of pecan trees, so they, you know, the pecan limbs come down like crazy, so I'll just build a fire in the backyard. The 3-year-old son loves that. Build a fire in the little fire pit, and then when the coals get down, we'll either transfer them over to the grill or we'll maybe just do like hot dogs or steaks right over the fire pit.
Do big barbecue operations, they don't use any kind of like lighter fluid, right? How do they get things going when the fire's built?
Well, you also have to remember that a lot of these places are cooking nonstop. So you're really talking about how do they light the fire maybe once a week. So if they're closed maybe one day a week, that's to clean out the pits.
Yeah.
So if you go to a place like Franklin Barbecue, he wraps all of his brisket in butcher paper. All that butcher paper gets really laden with beef fat, and so he just saves a little of that, puts some wood kindling on it, and lights the fat-soaked butcher paper, and it takes off pretty easily. But in the backyard, if you're cooking in the backyard, there's certainly no shame in starting off with charcoal to at least get your fire started and to heat your pit up, and then add wood on from there.
Do you, is there any point in having like the most expensive grill? It seems like grills and strollers have gotten like insanely expensive, and I don't know, maybe there's a difference and maybe you're still rolling from point A to point B with a, you know, $5,000 grill.
Yeah, well, some of it comes down to having that status symbol. I mean, if you buy the Jambo pits that are made over in Fort Worth, they have a car finish on them. They're beautiful pits, and they cook very efficiently. But really, it really comes down to efficiency. Like, if the cheaper the smoker, the less efficient it's going to be. Now, if you can deal with that, and you can baby the fire, and you can baby the meat, then maybe that, you know, $60 water smoker is fine for you. Maybe you need to go to more like a $500, a little bit thicker metal offset smoker, or you know, maybe you just need the that Cadillac, that, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 smoker to make sure you don't have to tend the fire as much.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have John on the line in Dallas. Hey, John.
Hey there. My question is, what are the distinct characteristics of Texas barbecue versus, like, let's say, Oklahoma barbecue? I've lived in both places, and I love both types, but I'm not sure what the different characteristics are that separate the two regions.
Thanks for your call. You've asked the right guy.
Yeah, well, you know, Oklahoma barbecue certainly has a lot of the same things on the menu that Texas has. They've You're going to find brisket and ribs. One of the things you're going to find almost everywhere in Oklahoma is smoked bologna. And that's just not something...
Like the lunch meat bologna?
Like the lunch meat bologna, yeah. Now, you're not going to find that in a lot of places in Texas. Up towards the Red River, there's a place up in Grapevine, Bartley's Barbecue, that does serve smoked bologna. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but by and large, you're not going to find bologna in Texas. And one of the things you will find in Texas that really defines what Central Texas-style barbecue is smoked sausage and homemade smoked sausage. So taking the trimmings from brisket, taking the trimmings from your pork ribs, grinding that up yourself, stuffing it into a casing with some seasonings and smoking that. That is something that really defines Texas barbecue that doesn't really have an equivalent in most other types of barbecue. Most other types of barbecue, it's an argument over whether it's pork or beef or a combination. In Texas, one of the things that really does define us is that smoked sausage.
So often when people have business colleagues come into town, they say, where should we go for barbecue? Give us a couple ideas in Fort Worth, a couple in Dallas, maybe a couple elsewhere in the general North Texas area that are worth recommending.
Yeah. Well, you know, here in Dallas, we've talked about a few already. The Slow Bone, open for lunch every day. Pecan Lodge is open Tuesday through Sunday for dinner on Friday and Saturday evenings. Just go to the express line there and get the trough. You'll get a little bit of everything, and you won't have to wait in that long line. It's a little bit of a pretty well-known secret, I guess. Lockhart Smokehouse is also one I love here. And then Cadillac Barbecue is one that's come on lately. They're only open Thursday and Friday for lunch. So that one's a little bit harder to get to if your plans aren't so flexible. Over in Fort Worth, so there's Billy's Oak Acres up on the northwest side, and I love that place. It's a cool building. It's a converted bar. They have an old brick pit there from the 50s. It's just got a cool look to it. And then and the food's good, too, of course. And some of the best banana pudding you're going to find anywhere. Also, I talked about the Hardeman's family a little bit back here in Dallas. So the one at Keast and Hampton, they do banana pudding only on Fridays. Yeah. And it is fantastic. Also, if you go a little bit southwest of Fort Worth, you get to Crescent, Texas, and in a Texaco gas station is Barbecue on the Brazos there, and they're really doing some great stuff over there.
Awesome. So I guess you have to not judge before you taste, because you can find something in a Texaco station.
Yeah, that's right. Not judging before you taste, and also just making it a point to try to go to as many places as possible, and also try not to judge the methods by which people are cooking with before you taste it. I mean, for me, what comes out on the tray is more important than exactly how it got there.
What do you feel like you have a sense for now that you didn't a few years ago when you started this?
Well, I think now I just tend to look at places as, can I send somebody here? Can I recommend something at this place? And maybe it's just one item that is really worth traveling for. And instead of looking at the whole menu, I want to be able to, you know, really reward places that have that specialty, that do one or two things really well, that are worth traveling for, worth eating, rather than saying, well, you know, not everything was perfect, or not maybe the brisket wasn't so great. But really trying to find also what their goal is, too. You know, is their goal to make an incredible rack of ribs? Or is it to make, you know, and maybe brisket's just kind of something that they don't pay as much attention to. So, I try to not be so rigid as far as, like, the whole menu's got to be great to give it a great recommendation.
Daniel Vaughn is barbecue editor for Texas Monthly. His blog for the magazine can be found at tmbbq.com. He's also the author of the 2013 book, The Prophets of Smoked Meat, A Journey Through Texas Barbecue. Daniel, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show by sending email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.